Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The oil boom is on in McKenzie County, North Dakota. More than 4,000 wells have been drilled since 2008, and the county expects they'll be pumping for decades. A 2013 report by the Local Development Corporation predicts more than 8,600 wells by 2025. These wells are part of the thriving domestic oil production that surpassed oil imports for the first time in two decades. Maybe you heard about that benchmark passed last fall, or maybe you've heard stories or seen pictures of the work camps popping up on the Dakota fields, along with the businesses launched to feed, clothe, and entertain workers. But what do they look like? Earlier this summer, journalist Tom Haynes, who also teaches journalism at UNH, went to find out for himself. He walked 65 miles through the heart of McKenzie County and met ranchers and farmers and geologists and oil workers. He tracked his trip on a blog called Fuel Walk, A Journey Across America's Energy Landscapes, and joins us now to fill us in with more. Tom, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
So what did you know about what McKenzie County looked like before this oil boom all started?
Very little. I mean, I had driven across North Dakota a few times, and I had worked in eastern North Dakota as a journalist. I knew it was plains. It's the part of the High Plains. This boom is in western North Dakota, which is has some of the badlands and is more rugged. The Missouri River cuts through the northwest corner. But, you know, I had images of prairie and farmland and I suppose oil wells.
What does it look like now?
All of that. I mean, it is depending on where you are and depending on how far you cast your gaze, you can see sort of snapshots of time. You can be standing and you can see the typical abandoned old farmhouse, wooden farmhouse with grass growing up through the roof, or you can see a wide open field full of canola or flaxseed. But if you were to rotate a few degrees in any direction, pretty soon you'd see either an oil well pumping away. These are wells that have been drilled over the last 5 or 6 years, or some actually there were smaller booms in the 50s and 80s. But you would also see dozens, if you were to look far and wide, of oil rigs drilling. So this is the Bakken oil boom drilling down into the Bakken shale formation to get oil and gas.
And this has happened so very quickly. I mean, that's my understanding of it, that it is actually like the Wild West. Did it feel like that for you?
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, I've reported all over the world, and I've never been any place quite like this as far as being in the center of a moment. You know, and this is the story of gold rushes and oil rushes throughout time, you know, that something is struck and people move in. But there's a confluence here. I mean, this is happening at modern time, in modern technology, and we have global markets and incredible infrastructure of trucking and transportation to get things into a place quickly. The rush is on. So they've known this oil has been there for years, but it's never been economically viable. Oil prices are high enough that there are companies everywhere, ConocoPhillips, XTO, Whiting Oil, Continental Resources. They're everywhere. And North Dakota has a regulatory structure that encourages that. Mineral rights trump everything. So if an oil company can negotiate with a mineral rights holder to get oil, it's theirs.
Mm. You met a lot of people that you call internal migrants, refugees of sorts, mm-hmm. from other poor economies around the country who came looking for work. Can you give us some? I know you met a lot of them, but generally, how do they live? How many are there? What's their life like?
So you're right. I mean, it's striking, right? It's a real window into the broader U.S. economy to wander around and talk to people. I wasn't even keeping track, but it struck me about 6 or 7 days into it. I made a list of the states that I had met people from, and without even really asking everybody. And I was at 31, just sort of jotting them down, everywhere from Maine and New Hampshire to Florida to California, a lot of the Rocky Mountain West. And so first of all, what you hear over and over again of stories, people with quote-unquote normal lives back home, they had had a job, they had a mortgage, they had a house, and they lost it. Times got tough. And so they loaded up their truck and they headed out to North Dakota. I met a lot of those people in really sort of ad hoc camps where trailer parks would be set up and they would sign a lease for $650 a month to put their camper there, and they'd sign on for work, and they'd start working $25 an hour and see if they could make it all work.
How about for the ranchers and the farmers and the locals? How has the boom changed their economic, certainly, and social lives?
Yeah, so it depends. You know, that's the biggest impact I heard about from ranchers was sort of that social question, the kind of quality of life and sort of traditions, right? This is a very isolated place. It's one of the last places in the lower 48 states to get settled. It's a quiet place. And a lot of people talk about that loss of community. You know everybody. Having said that, it's been a very bad economy for decades. And I think a lot of ranchers I talked to were sort of straddling this kind of happy and sad divide between we need the jobs, we need the work, it's good to have something coming in and keeping this going, and yet it's changing our way of life. A second piece of that that's really important is in North Dakota, mineral rights and surface rights are not always connected. So it depends on who you are. If you're a rancher who keeps your mineral rights and an oil company comes along,
you can make a lot of money.
Millionaires. As one woman said who's from an old-time family, there are millionaires being made here every day, and it's true. If you're a rancher who maybe your grandfather or grandparents in the 1930s, before mineral rights were worth much, sold them to buy a tractor. They sold them to somebody in town. That person's left, and now there's a great niece in Los Angeles who has those mineral rights. And the oil company goes out and negotiates the lease with the niece in Los Angeles. She'll become a millionaire, and the farmer back home now has three oil rigs within 500 feet of his house. So it's really complicated. And what's interesting to me is it's just a real case study in the trade-offs we make in our rush to kind of feed our energy appetite.
We're getting a slice of America's new energy reality with Tom Haines, who's a journalist. He also teaches journalism at UNH. He trekked across the heart of McKenzie County, that's in North Dakota, which is one of the areas of the country that's been transformed by the domestic oil boom now going on in the U.S. So this young geologist you speak to, he says this isn't going away. There's money to be made. How did people react to you? What did they think when they saw you trekking along with your backpack? Suspicious?
So no, this was, it was the most fun I'd had in a long time, both journalistically and just personally in terms of like travel, because I would be walking down this, a 4-mile stretch of dirt road in the middle of the prairie, and a pickup truck would go by with two oil workers in it. And they'd slow down, and the first reaction was kind of, either they wouldn't stop because they almost couldn't believe that I was out there with my backpack, or if they slowed down, we'd talk, which happened all the time. There was this camaraderie. We were sort of in it together. They'd say, "What are you doing out here?" And I'd explain, "Oh, I'm writing, stories, and I'm out here writing about the oil patch, and I'm walking because I want to see life." And they'd kind of shake their head, and the next question they'd say is, "Well, do you have enough water? Or where are you going to sleep? Take care of yourself." There was a lot of this kind of what I imagined has always existed in these places. On the one hand, yeah, it's a hard life. There's a lot of bad stuff. And we can, I talked to people about crime increasing and all this stuff. But there's also a lot of sort of, for lack of a better term, like shared humanity, where people are kind of looking out for each other. And I think that people saw me coming down the road with my backpack and they think, he's out here too, just like us. So that was really just an incredible part of the trip.
Yet in Watford City, where you finally put down your pack, you meet somebody who says, there are drugs going on out here. There's activity. There's wildness. Just this kind of wildness.
Absolutely. And Watford City is interesting. It's the seat of McKenzie County. It's a town that, the statistics have almost become sort of common now. But a town like 6 years ago had 1,400 residents. So, very small town sitting on the high plains. Now they figure over 10,000, and I talked to some city people who said they are kind of working on the assumption there's 15,000 or 20,000 people around. They don't know because in these trailer camps. So with that has come everything. I've talked to the police chief in Watford City. There's drug trafficking is up. There are cartels that are bringing in drugs from big cities. There's prostitution. There's I talked to a domestic violence advocate. There's a lot of just sort of social problems and social challenges that have come with this press of people. And yet there's sort of as the minister said, a new normal emerging there. And they're kind of catching up to that. They're building a new high school. They're building a new hospital. They're building a new roundabout road. And there's kind of like the woman you mentioned in the campground where I stayed. It was a woman who said, people are waiting for civilization to catch up. And I feel like that's really what's happening.
Well, Tom, you've been back a couple weeks now, and somebody did ask you at the end of your trip, any big epiphanies, you know, and of course it takes time to think about those things, and I'm wondering about that. You know, do you think differently about getting in your car and driving? Do you think differently about using the energy that you and your family use now that you've seen at least one source?
Yes. I mean, I think if there's one thing, my general motivation in doing this, and I'm going to be doing some other trips along this line, was to go to the source and to kind of connect myself and hopefully through writing and telling the stories, connect readers and listeners to that too. And that is the overwhelming kind of sort of takeaway for me, is how intimate this process is. You know, our consumption of energy is completely unintimate. You know, we don't know where it comes from. You pump something out of a gas. Did it come from the Nigerian Delta? Did it come from the Middle East? Did it come from the Gulf of Mexico? We don't know, right? When we turn on our lights, is that fueled by coal or natural gas? Who knows? We're not really paying attention to this, and who has time? But in the end, the harvesting of every bit of fuel that powers our lives happens somewhere really specific, and it's harvested by someone very specific, you know, an individual who's working on the pump, and it's happening in the yard of a rancher or their family who, you know, they're standing out there waiting for the bus, and there's the oil rig, their well water, you know, all these different things. And so I think that's my takeaway, is just that in this era when it's so easy to feel that we're not connected, we are. You know, we're all connected to this, and so it ties back into bigger questions about where is it all going.
Journalist and UNH professor Tom Haines, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Haines walked 65 miles through the heart of North Dakota oil country and tracked his trip on a blog called Fuel Walk, a journey across America's energy landscapes. You'll find more at wordofmouthradio.org. At just 43 acres, it wouldn't take Tom Haines very long to walk across Star Island, but he would certainly see some interesting approaches to energy happening along its shores. Up next on Word of Mouth, Star Island's efforts to go solar. That's after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Star Island, a 43-acre spit of land in the Isles of Shoals, is installing enough solar panels to power roughly 30 homes and a battery array to back them up. While this may seem like a drop in the bucket for green energy, its efforts to go solar are actually a culmination of years of work that some think could be a model for how the future of energy might look on the mainland. NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown brings us this story.
Star Island has been an idyllic retreat for conference goers for over a century. Today, island goers come to learn about meditation, bird watching, the history of the Isles of Shoals, or many other topics. These retreats draw a community of lifelong Star Islanders.
Oh, we're playing Salt and Pepper Bocce. So you slide, oh!
Anne Shanks Etter is sliding salt and pepper shakers back and forth on a table in the dining hall with lifelong friends she's met here.
I mean, I was gone for 23 years, and I came back, and there's people I knew, it was things that I, traditions that I still remembered, so things don't change a ton. Nice shot.
One thing that will never change is that keeping a hotel and conference center going on an isolated island takes brute force. In the high season, diesel generators churn 24 hours a day to keep the lights on. Filters purify water and pumps run constantly to push it around the island. Water from showers, washing dishes, and flushing toilets has to be cleaned at a miniature wastewater treatment plant near the shore. And supplies of all kinds have to be shipped from the mainland on diesel-powered ferries and cargo boats, says the island's director of facilities, Jack Farrell.
The island has always had sort of, an understanding of the limits of our resources. That's the nature of an island.
Farrell says making electricity with diesel-powered generators has always been a little contrary to that ethic of conservation.
At night when people went to bed, it was beneficial to leave the lights on because the generator was more happy when it had a full load. So some of our lights don't even have switches.
But in recent years, the price of diesel has soared, and those who live and work on the island want a more environmentally friendly approach. They're installing enough solar panels to cover a space a little bigger than a tennis court and a bank of batteries to store the electricity. That means everything will be on a switch and carefully switched off when no one's in the room. During shoulder season, spring and fall, the panels would provide all of the electricity the island needs, and in the winter, the island powers down. But going solar really only scratches the surface of the energy picture on Star Island. Despite being in a spot surrounded by abundant water, water accounts for the top three energy draws on the island. Hot water for washing dishes and laundry, a machine that purifies salt water for drinking, and the tanks that treat wastewater before flushing it into the ocean. So years before the work began on the solar panels, the nonprofit began investing in changes to water that would save them money right off the bat. Like a dishwasher that uses less.
With something that uses a third of the water, it's kind of a hat trick for energy because it's a third of the water supply, a third of the wastewater, and a third of the heated water. So it's really, this is a real win-win, I guess.
The hotel uses around 6,000 gallons a day and can store 8,000. Potable water comes from a couple of sources, explains Kristen Samard, the island's environmental service manager.
So we have two reverse osmosis units that we use. Those filter salt water to fresh water.
That's the first, which takes a lot of electricity, so they don't like to use it.
We also can take drinking water from boats.
That's the second. Every time the ferry brings guests to the island, it can drop off 2,500 gallons of water from the mainland. And the third is...
We collect rainwater off the roofs of the main buildings. That's the hotel and cottages A and B. We collect all of that in a cistern that's under the Atlantic House.
Some of that water is saved to run the sprinklers in case of a fire. And finally, the toilets are flushed with salt water.
Right, because we don't have enough water on this island, so it would be a huge waste of our resources to flush our toilets with this hard-won water.
Though it does mean that they occasionally have to scour baby mussels out of their pipes. So if you're looking to shrink your energy needs on Star Island, how do you tackle the water problem? First, run the reverse osmosis machines as little as possible.
Something we're trying to move into is filtering collected rainwater up to drinking water standards.
They're also installing another water tank in their cargo boat. Later this year, they'll update their wastewater treatment plant. And last year, they started sending most of their laundry to the mainland for cleaning. And then there's this guy.
We're in our cogeneration plant.
So
those who are listening is a very small shed.
Marshall Fry's official title is Island Engineering Technician. He's the architect of Operation Death to Boilers, which reimagines how the island heats its water.
I'm not actually an engineer.
Fry used a heat exchanger designed for use on a boat to suck energy out of the exhaust from the generator and use it to heat water. It started running for the first time on the day of our visit. That, along with some electric and propane water heaters as backup, totally replaced the island's ancient water boilers.
The big ticket item was getting rid of the boilers, and that saved us about a third of our diesel usage.
All of these changes together mean that before the solar panels ever come online, Star Island has cut its diesel use by around a quarter, or 5,000 gallons a year. Clay Mitchell is a renewable energy guru with Revolution Energy based in Exeter, who helped design the island's new solar setup. He says the solar panels might be sexy, but the real grunt work of getting the island over its diesel addiction is being done by saving energy first.
Getting that load down to a point where it could be managed and produced was the most important part.
Ultimately, though, Star decided not to ditch its generators entirely. The batteries and solar will work together with the generators in a hybrid system. Mitchell says electricity on the island will basically function like Chevy's gas-electric car, the Volt.
Where the batteries are running the whole system and the solar power is providing power to keep the batteries going. And then if the batteries get to a certain level, the generators have to kick on to keep the batteries charged up.
The generators would run basically only at night during the high season and not at all during the rest of the year. This is what's known as a microgrid, which is a very vogue term now in energy circles. The idea is that if each neighborhood had a little electric grid of its own, it would mean that fewer people would spend weeks without power after a big storm, among other benefits. So far, though, despite years of talking about them, there aren't many around.
I was at a conference recently where they referred to microgrids as something that's like unicorns or Bigfoot.
Susan McDonald is the community energy director at the Island Institute and helps islands all up and down New England's coast reduce energy costs.
Well, we do have microgrids, and they are these diesel islands in New England.
Diesel-fueled island communities pay upwards of 70 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity, which is four or five times what people pay on the mainland.
The price of energy in particular has really pushed people to think a lot harder about conservation and renewable energy in a way that some people think may happen on the mainland, if there was a carbon tax.
In other words, if energy prices continue to climb, one can imagine a world which starts to look like Star Island. Once it's all said and done, Star hopes it will be able to replicate the experience of Nashon Island near Martha's Vineyard, which the Forbes family owns, and at The Rock, or Alcatraz. Both islands installed similar hybrid systems. On Nashon, efficiency and solar have cut its diesel use by two-thirds. The work on Star Island is expensive. They have a hard time coming up with an exact cents per kilowatt hour number for everything they've done, but the solar array alone on Star will cost around $1 million. But in a place where diesel fuel is delivered at great cost by a barge a few times a year, a project like this makes financial sense. And as island manager Jack Farrell makes clear, their project is also driven by their philosophy, which is shaped by the island's ties to the Unitarian Universalist Church.
This is a special place, and it's here to be a place to imagine the world as it might ideally be, as our vision statement says, if I can paraphrase it. And we take that very seriously.
For years, that adage referred to how people treated each other on the island. Going forward, it'll also be a vision of what our energy grid could someday be. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Coming up, after nearly reaching extinction in the 20th century, great whales are rebounding in a big way. Up next, we're going to hear how the continued whale recovery could help reverse the effects of climate change. That's after the news, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Consider the subtleness of the sea. How its most dreaded creatures glide under water, unapparent for the most part, and treacherously hidden beneath the loveliest tints of azure. Consider once more the universal cannibalism of the sea. All whose creatures prey upon each other, carrying on eternal war since the world began.
That is Benedict Cumberbatch for the Moby Dick Big Read Project, featuring celebrated actors and everyday people reading Herman Melville's classic aloud. The writer and cultural historian Philip Hoare curated that project and is here to consider a less subtle topic, the carbon-absorbing benefits of whale feces. After nearly reaching extinction in the 20th century, great whales are rebounding. A global team of researchers at the University of Vermont report that the continued recovery of whales has a powerful effect on ocean ecosystems and could even help reverse the effects of climate change. Philip is passionate about whales. We found that out when we spoke with him about his recent book, The Sea Inside. More recently, he wrote about the potential for whale poo to reverse the effects of climate change for The Guardian. Philip, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's lovely to be back on the show.
So it is hard to imagine that an increase in waste material from a creature would help our climate woes. We think of methane from cow manure, for example, actually contributing to greenhouse gases. What is it about whale poo?
It's a very basic thing, Virginia. You think of your garden grows on manure, cow poo, well, whale poo does the same, only it's actually fertilising the phytoplankton, which are the microscopic and not so microscopic plants in the ocean. And I can tell you this on first-hand evidence. I have been at the wrong end of a whale when he decided, or she, I think it was actually, decided to do its business. And it's not solid. It's very cloudy. It's like a sort of cloud of brown, very smelly stuff. So in the food chain, you know, the food chain where the phytoplankton feed the zooplankton are what the sand eels are feeding on. You and I were talking about the whales off Cape Cod at the moment. A lot of whales out there feeding like crazy. I mean, they are eating a ton of sand eels a day.
So that makes sense. I can imagine the whole food chain going up to the whale and turning back around in this kind of ocean ecosystem. But what difference does that make for the atmosphere at large outside of the ocean?
Because as with trees, as with plants on the ground, plants, phytoplankton fix, they actually draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. At the same time, of course, then they give out oxygen, the oxygen we breathe. 50%, some people say 60% of the oxygen we breathe comes from phytoplankton. If you imagine the huge surface of the ocean, the world is covered by ocean. I mean, two-thirds of the planet's surface is ocean. That's in a tremendous amount of oxygen being given out, carbon dioxide being taken in. In fact, one of the reasons why climate change isn't accelerating in extraordinary ways that it might be is because the oceans have become a carbon sink. Actually, they are sequestering, they are drawing in carbon dioxide and actually protecting us.
Well, one of the big pieces of news about this University of Vermont study and report is that whale populations are recovering and rebounding since, what, near extinction, I guess, in the 20th century. So is there any correlation between growth in greenhouse gases in the 20th century and the decline of whale population? Could they have made that much of a difference, I guess, is the question.
Who knows? We can't call that now. But the idea is that there were hundreds of thousands of whales taken out of the out of this chain in the 20th century especially. I mean, it's quite ironic. If you look at the period of Yankee whaling, which was at its height in the late 18th and early 19th century, killed not really very many whales. Most whales died, actually, within my lifetime in 1966, more whales were killed than the entire 150 years of the peak of Yankee whaling, of the Moby Dick period, if you will.
Wow.
So there were hundreds of thousands. I mean, we think now 300,000 blue whales were taken in the 20th century. We know that the population of sperm whales was 1.2, maybe 1.5 million before hunting began. It was reduced down to 300,000, maybe even fewer. Now, we know those figures are now creeping up. There is a perceptible advance in the numbers. We know that off the east coast of Australia at the moment, they're having 10% more humpback whale calves are coming back to that coastline each year. So this is a good news story. We need to really shout about it because we can give ourselves a pat on the back. We don't do a lot of brilliant things sometimes to the environment, but this is one thing we've really done well, actually. And it's partly because, you know, that moratorium on whaling is observed by pretty much every nation in the world. We know there are exceptions. We know that Japan, Norway and other smaller nations do still hunt whales, but generally it's observed by everyone, and it is a good news story.
Philip, there are varying different reports on how quickly we will approach this point of not being able to turn back the irreversible damage done to the planet. Given that, you know, and given that we don't yet know the effect of whale poop, among other natural combatants to climate change, do we have time to think about that rather than these geoengineering projects that have been proposed, you know, putting mirrors up in the sky, seeding clouds, other kinds of proposals that are a bit more radical than waiting for the natural process?
Well, sure. And the geoengineering projects are pretty sci-fi stuff. I mean, as you say, you know, they're creating artificial volcanoes to spew sulfur into the air and create a kind of shield against the sun's rays. Enormous mirrors to deflect the sun's rays erected in outer space. To me, they're just a bit macho, to be honest. You know, it's really within the capability of all of us to change our behaviour in a way, and not to rely on science to dig us out of the hole, really. You know, the problem is that a lot of people are sceptical about what science is saying about climate change. So, you know, it's an uphill struggle sometimes. But I think this whale story is a really important aspect of the way we have to look positively and optimistically about what can be done and about the way nature itself can really conquer what we've done. And a lot of the scientists are saying that, you know, if we adhere to some of the restrictions on carbon emissions, that we can roll back. We can roll back what seems to be an inevitable process.
Well, until then, we rely on whale poo. Philip Hoare, I want to thank you so much. Great to speak with you again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Virginia.
Philip Hoare is a writer and a cultural historian. You'll find a link to his article for The Guardian, Why Whale Poo Could Be the Secret to Reversing the Effects of Climate Change, as well as our earlier conversation about his book, The Sea Inside, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Could whale poo reverse climate change? A single question, even the most giggle-inducing, can be a powerful force. It can open up an entire field of study. It can take up residence in someone, shaping who they become. And it can jump inside of other people, infusing them with a burning curiosity. Reporter Ari Daniel has the story of just such a question.
Our story begins in downtown Atlanta, in a park no bigger than a tennis court.
Standing here, you are looking at an uncountable field of daffodils.
Dabney Dixon works just around the corner.
So I was walking by here yesterday, and I go, whoa, I wonder what specific molecule makes it that beautiful color yellow. Carotenoids.
By the way, Dixon's a chemist at Georgia State University.
Like music in the background, I can envision the molecules that make the color of our world.
Knowing how molecules paint color onto the world is deeply gratifying to her. But back in Dixon's office, she says for a while, all she had was the question.
When I was a little girl, I would say, what makes things colors? And people would say, well, Dabney, molecules make things colors. And I would go, yes, yes. But what makes a blue molecule, and a green molecule? And I never met the people who knew the answer. And then I got to college and I took freshman chemistry, and I met the people who know what makes different molecules different colors. And so I went and became a chemistry major, and here I am all these years later.
The answer has to do with how molecules interact with white light, which contains all the colors of the rainbow. Each molecule absorbs different wavelengths of light, pulling colors out of that rainbow. The leftover colors, that composite, is what we see. Now Dixon gets to work with color all the time in her lab. It makes her work a lot easier because she can see where her molecules are when she's running her experiments. Her molecule of choice is heme.
Heme is what makes blood its bright red color.
Heme is found inside hemoglobin, the protein in red blood cells that transports oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body. It's a flat arrangement of atoms.
It has four nitrogen atoms in the middle, and those nitrogen atoms each hold on from four different directions, kind of north, south, east, west, to an iron atom in the middle.
Dixon studies bacteria, like the ones that cause strep throat, that consume the heme in our blood. Ultimately, they're after the iron, which they need to digest their food.
You don't think that there's much blood in your mouth, but tiny little cuts, there's enough blood to keep the Streptococcus bacteria happy and provide enough heme out of the hemoglobin to let the bacteria live quite handily.
Dixon's question these days is how a bacterium manages to get the heme from outside its cell to the inside, which for a tiny molecule is a long distance. Here's an analogy.
Let's imagine that we have a game that's a combination of ultimate frisbee and basketball. So the frisbee is the heme, large flat entity, and it's got a little bit of iron in the middle, so we'll tape a tiny little magnet to the middle of the frisbee. People are going to throw the frisbee one to the other, and then when it gets to the end, you need to get the frisbee down into the basket.
Bacteria have proteins embedded in their cell membranes, and the heme gets passed from one protein to the next, kind of like players tossing the frisbee down the line. The heme enters the cell when it passes through a channel, the bacterial equivalent of the basket.
Then it's destroyed by other proteins in the cell. They're basically going to throw the frisbee away because they just want that tiny little magnet. They want the iron.
Dixon wants to know how these bacterial proteins, some of which are totally unlike any proteins that have been described before, hold onto the heme, and how their shape changes when they release it to the next protein in the sequence. Understanding this and eventually tampering with it might lead to new antibiotics. And the fact that heme is red not only makes doing this work easier, it goes back to Dixon's lifelong love of color.
I get to see the beauty every day in the lab.
And Dixon doesn't keep her passion for color and chemistry to herself. She takes it on the road. Dixon stands in front of a class of third graders at the children's school in Atlanta.
We're going to show you pictures of molecules and atoms.
Dixon flashes a series of molecules onto a big screen.
Ready? Whoa. Whoa.
different colored spheres, which represent the atoms, pop into view.
It looks like a bunch of sprinkles.
It's like a hairball from a cat.
This molecule happens to be hemoglobin. At the end of the class, Dixon asks her two undergraduate helpers, Arielle Hackle and Stephanie Thompson, to field questions.
What made you want to be a scientist?
I always asked a lot of questions, and I wanted to find some answers, and I just felt like being a scientist was probably the best way to do that.
When I was your age, I loved science, and I knew that when I grew up, I wanted to be a scientist. Does anybody want to be a scientist when they grow up? Awesome.
Half the class.
Don't ever let it go. Go for it.
Their professor, Dabney Dixon, didn't meet a chemist until college. Now she's determined to meet as many kids as she can and introduce them not just to chemistry, but to a world full of colorful questions.
That story came to us from Small Matters and producers Ari Daniel and Misa Salaita. eBay, PayPal, and Amazon are e-commerce giants here in the U.S., but there's one company that is bigger and more profitable than all of them combined. Word of mouth continues with a closer look at the China-based e-commerce behemoth, Alibaba. That's after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You've heard of eBay, PayPal, Amazon, but there's one rising e-commerce company that's bigger and more profitable than all of them combined. You may have heard the name, but do you know what it is?
Alibaba.com. Global trade starts here at our online worldwide marketplace.
Alibaba.com.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zero Coal and Chief Explainer of All Things Wired here on Word of Mouth. He's here with a primer of the biggest company you know probably very little about. Rob, great to have you with us.
Always wonderful to be here, Virginia.
So what is Alibaba and what does it do?
Well, Alibaba's out of Hangzhou, China. They're the world's largest e-commerce internet company. And you're right, not too many people know about them. And their impending IPO coming up a little after Labor Day, they say, is probably the reason they're becoming front of mind. These folks, you know, basically control online commerce in China. They have over 80% of the online commerce in China. And that's huge because there are a billion people in China. More than three times more than the United States, and they get 80% of that revenue. The company was started in 99 by a teacher, a guy named Jack Ma. He was in San Francisco teaching English. Decided to start Alibaba with the vision of connecting Chinese manufacturers with overseas buyers.
Mm-hmm. So what can you buy on Alibaba?
Oh, I mean, almost anything manufactured in China at giant quantities, from bicycles to rubber bands to automotive parts. I mean, you name it. Anything manufactured is available there. But the Alibaba.com website really focuses just on that, on the large Chinese manufacturers to large, usually corporate, large quantity buyers. But Alibaba really is a holding company of a lot of other companies. The largest, most well-known is Taobao, which is the equivalent of our eBay. It's a customer-to-customer, consumer-to-consumer site, much like eBay, except they host about a billion products. 60% of the parcels delivered in China are sourced from Alibaba.
Wow.
They did $120 billion in sales in 2012, $250 billion in 2013.
Now, how does that stack up to something like an Amazon?
Oh, it's the sum of Amazon and eBay. I mean, their valuation, conservatively, what Wall Street's saying is that when Alibaba goes public, there will only be three tech companies in the world larger than them, and that'll be Apple, Google, and Microsoft in terms of market cap.
Now, you mentioned two platforms. You said Taobao and what else?
There's the Alibaba.com platform, which, of course, is their core, which is Chinese manufacturers to overseas buyers. Taobao, consumer to consumer. You can think of that as eBay. They have Alipay, which is their equivalent of PayPal. It's a payment escrow system. They have Tmall and 11 Main here in the United States, which is high-end shopping. They have eTao, which is a shopping search. Also, Alibaba bought Yahoo China. So actually, the entire Yahoo China property is owned by Alibaba. They have Alibaba Cloud, which is a cloud computing infrastructure similar to Amazon Cloud. And there are five or six other subsidiaries. But the company isn't just sales. They also have patents. They have over 350 intellectual property patents. And, it's just a staggering giant. I think this might be the largest IPO in history?
Well, it was set to happen right about now in mid to late July. Now it's been extended, holding off until after Labor Day, September 1st, it looks like. Now, why pushing it off?
Well, you know, I'll give you my opinion on that. The founder, Jack Ma, is unique. He has a wonderful priority in all of his decisions, and he's written this. It's his view is customers are first, employees are second, shareholders are third. And maybe you could say Jack Ma is last.
But and, I think he's making out pretty well.
Oh, he's you know, worth $10 billion today conservatively. I mean, he's doing just fine. Nobody's crying for Jack Ma. But he has that attitude, and his attitude has been that, you know, Wall Street is predatory. And his view is, I want to control this IPO. I want this IPO to go the right way, not the wrong way. They have a lot of people bidding for it. And my belief is that he wants his terms.
Well, there's a little scuttlebutt that I have picked up in my limited viewing of Alibaba, comparing the Alibaba IPO to Facebook. And the question is, like, will the stock be overvalued too quickly? Is that part of the thinking of holding off on this IPO?
It's possible. I think, though, that it's really clear what the revenue numbers are for Alibaba. $250 billion of sales in 2013. That's cash registers ringing. That's not people browsing and posting about their day. So in terms of valuation, I think it's a lot more clear what those numbers are going to be. Now, what the speculation is going to be, how much higher is it going to be driven when it goes to market? Gee, that's anyone's guess. But my view on it is that these guys are a dominant force in China, a dominant force in Asia, and the growth of the company is going to depend on how they expand beyond that area.
Are they doing business with American tech firms, however? Are they keeping it? I mean, we know that in many cases, Chinese businesses, state-owned, keep a kind of rigid control over who their businesses do business with.
You're right. Most of the subsidiaries, you know, the Alipays, the Can Boxes, their cloud services, absolutely. Vast majority of those services are inside of China only. And they can thrive because the Chinese market's so large. But things like Alibaba.com really depend on overseas buyers. So I suspect that their thrust going forward is going to be to expand into the United States and other areas. And one great example of that is inside of China, they have a site called Tmall, which focuses on high-end products, you know, luxury goods, things like that, really terrific stuff. All the big brands are there. All the U.S. brands are there because they want a piece of that Chinese market. However, they've expanded outside to a website called 11 Main, where they're basically saying, look, you know, we're trying to reach outside of China and appeal to non-Chinese buyers. So I suspect that their strategy is going to be to duplicate some of these services, at least the ones that are appropriate, outside of China and expand.
We're talking about Alibaba. That is the absolutely staggeringly huge e-commerce giant operated out of China that's going public, probably, if things go on schedule, in early September with Rob Fleischman. He's our chief explainer of all things Wired. Let's look at who's going to be making money off of this IPO, especially if it's such a scale. Yahoo used to own a 40% stake in the company. Alibaba bought back those shares for billions, apparently, in 2012.
That, Yahoo still has a large stake, though.
They do, what, 24% or
That's
something like
right.
that?
That's about right. There are three there are two plays that are interesting. You know, if you are a speculator and you'd like to put some money in the stock market on Alibaba, you pretty much have three choices. One, you could, of course, wait for the IPO and buy at the IPO, and we all know how risky sometimes that is. But right now, today, there are two publicly traded companies to consider. First, of course, is Yahoo stock. You know, you can buy Yahoo. They've been trading forever, and they're a pretty commonly held stock held by a lot of people. Some people think they're undervalued given their ownership in Alibaba and that impending IPO. The other one is a company called SoftBank, which not too many people hear much about, but they own over 30% of Alibaba. Now, I'm certainly no financial advisor, and I certainly don't know if those are good bets or bad bets, but those are the truth. Those are two major shareholders of Alibaba pre-IPO.
One more question. Alibaba got big by buying up a lot of smaller companies. Any chance that it's going to do that here in the U.S.? Is that part of its strategy? And will it become a household name?
You know, there's a lot of rumors that post-IPO that Alibaba might actually buy Yahoo, which is a wild thing to think about. But if you look at the financial sense of it, it makes a lot of sense for Alibaba. Yahoo has, of course, a large reach. It has email. It has really deep roots in Americans in terms of our commerce, in terms of our news, in terms of our delivery. Giant customer base might be an ideal acquisition. And I guarantee they're going to make a number of acquisitions once they go public. And Yahoo might be a big one. Maybe they'll do it. Maybe they won't. But there's been some speculation.
Rob Fleischman with no direct advice on buying stock. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here, Virginia.
Rob is CTO at Zero Coal and chief explainer of all things Wired for Word of Mouth. You can find out more on Alibaba and the upcoming IPO. There are links at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you missed any part of the show, fear not. Word of Mouth has a daily podcast. You can listen to the show in its entirety anytime you'd like. You can subscribe by visiting our website, wordofmouthradio.org, where you'll find a link to our full shows in iTunes. And if you like the show, please share the podcast link with a friend. From Manchester, New Hampshire to Manchester, England, your friends can listen to the podcast wherever they may reside. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.